Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the Rittenhouse jury is still out. But there was some developments in the case yesterday, including a new motion from defense for a mistrial based on an alleged discrepancy with respect to video evidence that the prosecution presented during their case in chief that was given to the defense in a compressed form, and the defense alleging that, well, they would have taken a different approach to that prosecutorial evidence had they received the video in the form in which the prosecution had it. Now, there's some supposition out there, you know, sort of the armchair analyzing going on about the prosecution, given its bizarre and incredibly weak case, that the prosecution is going for a mistrial, that this has been the purpose.
Right.
I'm not sure about that, and I also think the defense actually doesn't want the judge to declare a mistrial, but they want to be on the record as flagging what the prosecution has done at every turn because it's wonderful grounds for appeal in the unlikely occurrence that Kyle Rittenhouse is convicted of any of the crimes for which he's charged.
But aren't you nervous that the longer this goes on that they're trying to find something to charge him with, or do you just think that they're methodically going through all five charges?
It's hard to really get into a jury's mind like that. I mean, there's all these handles about, you know, quick verdict, that's bad for the prosecution, longer verdict, that's better. You know, they're poring over the evidence. But you can kind of theorize it both ways. They've asked to see the video evidence again. Right. It could be maybe there's one or two skeptics, you know, I'm not 100% with the majority right now, so Let me. I want to see that video evidence again, or I want to see this piece of evidence, or I want a transcript of this testimony read back to us. Just so I can be certain. I mean, it could be something as simple as that too. So I wouldn't read too much into, you know, the jury being out for a couple of days when you have as much evidence that's been presented in as politically charged a case as this is, and this is of course well understood by the jury. I mean, they're not living in a bubble. They understand the implications. They're from the community that was sacked by these rioters last year.
And here's
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text
line.
If
you see what the prosecution said that they were going to play in court and what they actually played in court, it is huge. Huge difference. And the defense, you know, asked the judge.
We've watched the video. I can tell you what we think. But it doesn't matter what we think because we don't get to present that to the jury.
Right.
No, and understood. But again, I don't think the defense actually wants a mistrial. I think they want, and I'm sure Rittenhouse wants, an acquittal. And I think based on, again, the prosecution's case, the evidence, even as presented, even with this piece of evidence and controversy, I just don't see how you convict. And by the way, the backdrop of this too, this was an interesting comment by Judge Bruce Schroeder, who's the presiding judge in this case, is the media coverage. I mean, this is attended. Alan Dershowitz, the vigilante in this case, is the media. They're the ones trying to put their finger, if not their entire elbow, on the scales of justice. I think he's right about that. Here's Judge Schroeder reconsidering TV cameras in the courtroom going forward.
We're there in part, not fully, but in part, because of grossly irresponsible handling of what comes out of this trial. I will tell you this, I'm going to think long and hard about live television of a trial again next time. I don't know. I've always been a firm believer in it because I think the people should be able to see what's going on. But when I see what's being done, it's really quite frightening. Frightening, that's the right word for it.
Yeah, because he was under fire for letting Rittenhouse pull the juror alternates out of that, you know, that the tumbler that you play bingo with.
I'm now reading about how bizarre and unusual it was to have the defendant pick the numbers out of the tumbler yesterday.
But that's what they do in Wisconsin. Like everything he's done, he's being scrutinized for.
Well, yeah, right down to the ringtone on his phone.
Exactly.
And Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University, was on Fox, and he talked about the media in the context of this very weak case the prosecution has presented and their focus on making the judge the scapegoat here. So if Rittenhouse is acquitted is because the fix was in, the judge was in the tank for Rittenhouse. This is the leftist line that you hear from all of their talking heads. Here's Turley.
So you have all of these people who say that they want the rule of law and equal justice who are piling on a judge who is upholding a rule that has the subject of numerous Supreme Court cases. But the other thing that's odd about all of this is it's like watching two different trials going on in Kenosha. You turn on some of these programs and they're praising the prosecutor. The prosecutor has made every error you could possibly list. It's a textbook case of what not to do at trial. He, in his opening argument, his opening statement, he promised the jurors things that he didn't produce. He just abandoned them. He said that, you know, he basically said, you're going to see a vigilante who is on something of a bloodlust. You know, he described this defendant as chasing down people. That just didn't materialize. And his credibility suffered as a result. But he also made glaring errors in terms of the facts of the case, even the law of the case. So I don't understand how you could look at this trial and blame the judge for the fact that it's collapsing in front of our eyes.
Jordan in Antioch, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. This has been my concern from the whole get-go, even prior to the TV trial. I think, and I hope, the reason it's taking so long is I think a lot rests on the initial contact between Rosenbaum and Rittenhouse. You know, Rosenbaum was unarmed. Rittenhouse was armed. And I'm not advocating, obviously, I want Rittenhouse to get acquitted, but it was a fist fight. And defensive law, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I am, where if it's a fist fight, hand on hand, whatever, you cannot escalate automatically to just shooting somebody.
Yeah,
you
but
have
I,
to take other measures.
But it wasn't a fist fight.
No.
Well, I understand that, but it was in a way. If you look at the fact that if you just look at the fact, it's Rosenbaum and Rittenhouse. It's two guys one on one. I hope what they focus on is the fact that one, he was outnumbered, so that's a force multiplier, so they can make it self defense that way. My concern is, and I think they're looking at it this way, is because the initial conflict between the two of them sets a precedent. If they deem that what he did to Rosenbaum was self-defense, then everything past that becomes self-defense because he's on his way to the police. If they deem that that was not self-defense because they don't look at it as the fact that he was not alone, Rosenbaum had somebody else there. There was another shot fired prior to that. You don't know what happened in that situation with Rittenhouse. If they say that that's not self-defense, then he's not running to the police in aid of the police because he was involved in a self-defense shooting. He becomes that active shooter in the eyes of the jury. That's my concern. And I hope, and I understand there's a lot of emotion, but when you break it down to just the simple fact that at the initial thing, it was two guys, one being chased, yes, the other being cornered, You can't automatically escalate what could be a fist fight into a shooting. And I don't agree with it, but that's how I think is how they're looking at it. And I think they want to get it 100% correct because of the media coverage, because of the sensationalism around it, because of the weight of what's going to happen based on what they I really think that the linchpin is breaking down that initial contact, because if it's self-defense, everything beyond that is self-defense. If it's not self-defense, Everything beyond that, he's an active shooter, and they are trying to. I know it sounds.
No, I know you're repeating yourself, though. Yeah.
Well, I understand that, but that's the point, and I think that's what they're looking at.
Thanks for the call, Jordan.
And Dan, I want you to hear this, and all of our listeners and our friends that live up in Mount Pleasant and Kenosha. Three BLM Black Lives Matter members were arrested yesterday. And listen to what this guy is saying. If you don't think that there's going to be civil unrest, I'd double check that.
We believe we're going to get some justice today. Maybe all the charges won't stick, but something's going to happen today. He's not going home.
He's not going home.
So back to what Jordan was saying. First of all, that's not necessarily true. I mean, you know, what's in the jury's mind, I don't know. But the idea that if they conclude Rosenbaum's shooting was self-defense, then everything is self-defense following that. I think everything was self-defense, including that and following that, but it doesn't necessarily logically follow. Because I have a reasonable fear for my life in one confrontation doesn't mean that I have a reasonable fear for my life in every subsequent confrontation, even in the context of a riot, okay? So it doesn't necessarily follow, but I think it is the case in this case. And if you look at that drone footage again, which is all over the place, the shooting of Rosenbaum by Rittenhouse, I mean, you have to look at the context, because what's the standard? The standard is like, oh, it's a fist fight and you escalated it using a firearm. No. The standard is I used the firearm because I had a reasonable fear of serious bodily harm or death. And by the way, the prosecution mischaracterized that video, which also speaks to either the incompetence of the prosecution or their understanding that when you see that video, you're going to conclude it was self-defense, because they say Rittenhouse was the aggressor, and you clearly see in the drone footage he is running away from Rosenbaum. Rosenbaum is chasing him. He comes around these parked cars, and you know he's at point-blank range when Rittenhouse shoots him.
And Rosenbaum was saying, "I'm going to kill you too." So don't forget about that too.
The entire context here is important, because you can't say this is a fist fight one mano a mano. That was not the case. This is what the prosecution was essentially attempting to argue in part in their close, but that just is belied by everything that transpired that night. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, thanks. Good morning, Dan and Amy, for taking the call. Okay, first of all, the facts and that video and all this, and everything that's come out has shown that it's exactly like you say. He just defended himself. It's plain and clear and everything. But hey, this whole thing, the way it got twisted up right from the beginning with the media, this goes to show just how dangerous and rotten this leftist media, and they should be part of the discussion, not just this prosecution being leftist and being dishonest and spinning and twisting everything up. But that kid is, he did everything textbook right. As far as self-defense with running, he was evading. He was evading taking shooting those people. His first choice was not to shoot. He ran. He was running every day. He's on his back. He's got these people coming at him every day. Anyone in a position. So this damn media is so bad, and that's part of the reason why you can't even have the verdict come out and everything like that without having all this kind of tearing up the city again.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Craig. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, again, there's no excuse this time for Evers and local authorities. You've got, months of planning that and all the resources that are necessary to maintain the peace regardless of the verdict, and really maintain the peace in the case of an acquittal, because that's really the only threat to the peace, an acquittal, because of who is making the threats. But there's no excuse, there's no reason that regardless of who is there and what their intentions are, that Kenosha shouldn't be prepared for whatever may come, and this time provide for the safety and security of their residents and business owners.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Hi.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So some new polling out on Mayor Triple Threat's reelection numbers, even though we're still 2 years out from her reelection.
Dan, it's February 20th, 2023, in case you're keeping track.
Year and a half, I guess.
Yeah, year and a half. It sounds further away than it will be.
Mike Flannery over at Fox Chicago reporting this survey done by Ogden and Fry. Majority of likely Chicago voters reject second term for Lori Lightfoot when asked if she deserves another term. Sort of the reelect question, would you vote to reelect her regardless of opponent?
Yeah, they break
68% of Hispanics, 62% of whites, 49% of blacks say no. And my question in response to that is, so what? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
What do you mean, so what?
So what? What do you mean, what do I mean?
Well, then why are we doing the story?
Well, because why we're doing the story? Because people are, why do you think we're doing the story? Because people take these numbers and completely become irrationally exuberant over the prospect that Lightfoot will be gone in 2 years or year and a half, and a new era of good feelings will be ushered in Chicago with some yet-to-be-named white knight that enters from stage left. That's why.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I would be one of those that I would say no. I'd be in the white section. I'd be 61.5% of whites joining them that she doesn't deserve four more years. I think she handled the pandemic horrifically, but more importantly than that, the way she treats police, the way she stood down during not one but two different riots in our city. Our downtown, I don't know if you've been there, it's destroyed. And they're going to have this magnificent lights festival, and they think a million people are going to come downtown. Heck no. In the last month, Dan, six major retailers on Michigan Avenue have been robbed.
Yes, the record of is there anybody in our listening audience who would vote to reelect Lori Lightfoot? Is there anybody who's unfamiliar with her record? Please give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. One listener who is going to vote to reelect Lori Lightfoot regardless of her opponent. Okay, now that we've got that set aside, that's not the question. The question is not Lightfoot's record. The question is, why do you think it gets better from here, whether she's reelected or she isn't? Does anybody have any institutional memory who lives in Chicago who's been there for more than 5 minutes? They don't. Well, very few people do. And so this is like the swallows to Capistrano. Oh, the mayor is in deep trouble, and you've got these problems and this problem and the crime problem. We went through this with Rahm. By the way, what was wrong with Rahm? I got that in response to my comment on this Flannery tweet about this polling. Well, what was so bad about Rahm? What are you talking about? But this is what I'm talking about. It's the same record. It's the same record, including the violence.
I felt safer with Rahm than I do with Mayor Lightfoot, because our police officers have been taken away and they're in different neighborhoods.
Yeah. Fine. The Rahm year, did you forget the Rahm year with 800 murders?
I remember it, yes.
So that's the record. I'm glad that you felt safer in Lakeview under Rahm. I'm talking about the city, not just Amy Jacobson's house. So I ask again, what is the difference? Lightfoot to work backwards. I'll try to talk slowly. Lightfoot.
Try not to be so condescending, please, but go on.
No, I'm not going to try not to be too condescending. I'm also not going to do that. So now I'm going to work back slowly. Lightfoot to Rahm, mm-hmm, to Daley. Are you counting with me?
Right.
To Sawyer, to Washington, to Byrne, to Old Man Daley. How many? Do you want me to go back all 100 years to Big Bill Thompson?
No, because Daley was in for a long time. And then after Daley, who was it?
What are you talking about? What?
You were walking back with the mayors.
Yeah, yes. I'm already back to Old Man Daley. How far back do you want me to go?
I don't need to go back any further.
Okay, and so answer the question, what has been the trajectory of the city over that time? So the last 50 years, Pick a quality of life sector. Police, schools, you know, police slash public safety, schools, economy, taxes. So the livability question. Yeah, we had this, you know, run up in, you know, sort of the 80s to the 2000s, and it was all built on sand. It was all predicated on spending beyond our means and grafting beyond our capacity to endure and conferring benefits that can never be paid to take advantage of the natural environment that Chicago enjoys to make it an attractive place. And so if you serve those who are doing well in River North and the Gold Coast and Lincoln Park, then that's the city. And it was people like me who are now frustrated that they have to say this again for the umpteenth time to people who are now all morally indignant about what's going on in this city. And if we just get rid of Lightfoot, how ridiculous, how embarrassing is this electorate? And people who should know better, people like me, ridiculed, ignored, said, you cannot have 80% of the city burn down around you and think that a half a dozen wards that are responsible for most of the wealth and most of the city's revenue won't someday be impacted. I said that when, midway through Mayor Daley's term, when when somebody first put a microphone in front of my mouth, when everything was hunky-dory and everybody folded in with Daley, and then everybody folded in with Rahm because Rahm was going to be an extension of Daley. And then Lori Lightfoot was a change agent because she never held elective office, and she was a lawyer at a big firm and a former prosecutor, and she's not personally corrupt, so that means it's going to be great. It's going to be even better than Daley and Rahm because she's not on the grift. She just wants the sash and the power, but she's really smart and she can also speak in complete sentences. So that's the threshold that you have to clear, and then things will be good. And are they?
She checks the boxes too. Lesbian, female, black. No, they're not good.
So why should anybody believe it gets better if she goes? You don't think it could get worse?
God, I don't know how it could. Well,
right. I don't know how it could get worse, which is what I heard from people from Bolandic in there too.
Oh, that's right.
From Bolandic to Byrne to Washington to Sawyer to Daley to Rahm to Lightfoot. How could it get worse? I mean, does anybody get tired of this? Obviously I do. And I'm so tired of dealing with simpletons in this city who have no capacity to forget, even think. I concede you can't think. Remember anything. They can't even remember what they lived through. It's pathetic. Sorry, I won't go along with the, yeah, let's all be morally indignant about the latest political hack on the fifth floor and the latest series of problems ushered in, built upon the problems of the political hacks on the fifth floor for the last 50 years. Sorry, I can't play. Oh, well, if that makes me mean or condescending, well, I can live with that. Greg in Jefferson Park. Hey, Greg.
Of course, if what Amy's been saying happens and we get that jackass Arnie Duncan in there, that's how it can get worse.
I mean, Pritzker's got to be funding him or something. He shows up at everything that Pritzker's involved in. Yeah, and for no reason he's there.
I went to the Republican committeeman's meeting, was here in Jefferson Park last week, and I was there. And,
good.
You know, these guys are talking a talk and trying to do some things, and, you know, they want to get, well, obviously you're missing about, what, 15 or so committeemen from the city, from these wards. But, you know, they're doing some good things, but, you know, they're talking about Illinois, you know, going red. It's like, guys, you got to be kidding. But one of the things that really concerned me was, he was saying that they were going to get a whole bunch of funding from Ken Griffin to go up against Pritzker. It's like, you know what? If you're going to spend $100 million, you know, going up against one guy who's got, you know, a couple billion dollars, why don't you spend that money on the city of Chicago and get good committee men, start getting some programs going to you know, get better jobs, you know, Griffin ought to buy a bunch of these schools that they closed, start them up as charter schools or do something else and give these people a reason to vote Republican and to do better things in the community. If Arne Duncan gets in there, it's going to be, we need more money for the schools. You know, they'll be paying $35,000 a year for Chicago public schools, and the kids will get dumber than they are now. Anyways, thanks. You guys have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Greg. No political competition. And it's because of, Ken Griffin's going to spend some money. Yeah, so what? Ken Griffin spent $50 million on Rahner last go-around. How'd that go against Pritzker?
Well, Ken Griffin's not running, right, Dan? I mean,
he's not running. But so what if he was?
Okay.
So what if he was? You know, come up with names. Come up with scenarios. Somebody's got a lot of money, or somebody knows somebody's got a lot of money, and they're going to spend a lot of money. And?
Or they have a good backstory. They, you know, went to war.
The money. The money thing. Money. What? Why are you talking? Why is any? I mean, to Greg's point, these committee men, they're trying to. You know, I know you're trying to grab onto shards of hope, but that is not an excuse for not living in this world. Ken Griffin's money isn't going to save the. It wasn't going to resurrect the Republican Party or save the state.
He did say, "What, you know, trying to turn Illinois red." That makes me laugh.
You want to know why there is no political competition in Chicago and Illinois? Because of statements like those that you just heard Greg relay. Not Greg's statements, but that he relayed. It is so evidently clear that nobody wants to do anything serious, as Greg was describing, the serious things that could be done, some of them. Nobody wants to take a stand on anything. Nobody really wants to do battle in the public square against these identitarian goons. Not any Republican, or very few. And so we're gonna somehow be saved by money that falls from Citadel. How ridiculous is that? You go to a meeting like that and you're a sensible person with a few firing synapses and you walk out and say, those are a bunch of people howling at the moon. I don't want any part of that. What a waste of time. Because it is. Michael on the South Side.
Hi. Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Mayor Lightfoot truly is a train wreck, but the scary part is she could actually win again. I mean, she's got 2 years to pass out favors to people, and there are a lot of liberals in Chicago who are going to vote for her no matter what. You know, in fact, the argument that's percolating on the South Side right now is that she inherited a mess, and COVID's not her fault.
Right. Sure. I mean, and thanks for the call, Michael. And
it's
you know,
a hard time to be mayor.
And it's also who she's going to be up against. You know, who is this super attractive candidate that provides a great contrast in a direction that a constituency can be built. Well, who either comes to the table with a constituency or who can build one while they're being torn down by Lightfoot and, you know, whatever constitutes her allies by the time 23 rolls around.
Dan, you don't think John Cantzara is an option? She's ready to take him on.
Could you give us your reaction to John Cantzara saying he plans to
Craig
run for
Wall,
mayor?
Channel 7.
He said, Mayor, yesterday, don't ruin the office. I'm coming for the keys.
It would be a gift.
In all seriousness.
In all seriousness, it would be a gift.
If he would run.
Let him run. I'd have a lot of fun with that.
Whatever. I mean, it's her like stupid bravado in her little Joe Pesci suit. But I mean, is Cantzara, can he put together a coalition in that city? I mean, that city is, I guess,
your city.
I live there. Can he put together a coalition? I mean, it's interesting coming from the FOP, from the rank and file side, as opposed to the chief side, like a Gary McCarthy, maybe. But, I mean, you know, he had a fight to be FOB president. That was a divided police force when it came to his election. And he's got, you know, targets. He's got, you know, quote-unquote baggage that can be exploited. And by the way, you know, I don't know that a election like a referendum on police from with Catanzara being the answer. I don't know that that wins in a city that is beset by identitarian politics, even among the critics of Lightfoot. Catanzara would definitely drive some critics of Lightfoot to her camp. And how does he put together the resources? It's not just about money, but you have to have resources.
But you maybe have to have it.
Maybe he gets the manpower from the ranks of FOP, but what about the other resources? How good a candidate would Catanzara be? I mean, no, we've had him on the show many times. I mean, I have nothing personal against him, but I mean, if you just want me to assess the matchup, that's a matchup that favors Lightfoot in Chicago. And by the way, you know, it's not going to be a one-on-one race. Now, maybe he could make the runoff, depending on how crowded the field is. But, you know, but he still has to finish in second slot, depending on what the field looks like. And who knows? Maybe he's not the only police that runs.
That's
true.
We
don't know.
And so, we could have 16 candidates like we did last time.
I mean, the idea that
19.
He can prove me wrong, but I don't see Catanzara. I don't see that happening. Ron and Sycamore.
Dan, Amy. Last night, I attended an event on the west side of Chicago at a high school. Mayor Lightfoot showed up, and I'm telling you, it's a cult of personality. Everybody just swooned over her. One police officer in full uniform did an interpretive dance at the high school. I don't know how she's going to be defeated because they love her.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ron. I mean, there's certainly people that don't. There's no question about it. That polling reflects it, and her numbers are not that strong. I mean, they would indicate that she's fairly vulnerable. But it's just more complicated than that. And, you know, there's a certain sickness in politics in general and in Chicago and Illinois in particular when somebody is omnipresent in your life. She is omnipresent because of the TV coverage and because she likes the attention and because she's at all these events and so on and so forth. I mean, she works the office. There's no question. She works the job.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's sort of a celebrity that becomes attached to a politician.
Yeah, she's on national news all the time. Shows and everything.
Yeah, but you don't even need to be. There's the celebrity that's attendant to it. And it's like, oh, you know, sort of like, I know her. That's the mayor. You know, people, you got at least, I don't know, a quarter to a third of the population that can't contemplate somebody other than an incumbent. Once they become an incumbent. Jim in LaGrange.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I think that the Chicago mayor position is that new place where you really and truly earn your national lefty chops to get out of here and then move to Washington. So kind of by falling in line, and as Amy mentioned, it's a national spotlight for now, could be failure by design. You know, look at Rahm. Rahm goes to Japan. Where's Lori going to go? Is she does she have the creds to be the new Secretary of State? Isn't that frightening?
Yeah, maybe North Korea, somebody your own size.
Department
Thanks for the call,
Justice.
Jim.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, after staying the implementation of the OSHA vax mandate on employers with more than 100 employees, essentially ruled that OSHA shall not continue its efforts to implement. And so OSHA is now suspending its efforts to impose the vaccine mandate and penalize companies who don't comply. The question becomes, what are you as an employer, or what is your company, if you are an employer with more than 100 or you're an employee in a company with more than 100, what are they going to do? Are they also relenting any moves they were making to comply. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Or did they listen to us and our conversation here about don't do anything yet unless you're a real COVIDian enthusiast? Hold your powder and wait for these cases to be adjudicated, because there may be no reason to impose this mandate. And that's not saying this has been disposed of in finality, but we're here right now. And so what is your company going to do? Or if you're a business owner, what are you going to do?
And we'd love to hear from you, because I know there's some business owners who said, I'm not going to do it until my feet are actually held to the fire on this, because people that have, you know, more than 100 people. But OSHA's already been, you know, they're at local hospitals. We know some of our listeners that work at Advocate Lutheran General. We used to be the old Lutheran General. Said OSHA members were walking through the hospital and taking pictures of employees whose masks weren't properly on, not over their nose or under their chin. So it was just weaponized. It was Biden's attempt to weaponize OSHA, you know, to go against Americans who weren't following his rules.
And again, this emergency temporary standard, and, you know,
great.
According to precedent, the bar is pretty high for these to be imposed. The November 12th order staying the implementation and enforcement, this opinion authored by Judge Kurt Engelhardt, this is pretty devastating. The mandate strained prescriptions combined to make it the rare government pronouncement that is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. It's over-inclusive, applying to employers and employees in virtually all industries and workplaces, with little attempt to account for obvious differences between the risks facing, say, a security guard on a lonely night shift and a meatpacker working shoulder-to-shoulder in a cramped warehouse. That's how it's over-inclusive. It's under-inclusive by purporting to save employees with 99 or more coworkers from a grave danger in the workplace, while making no attempt to shield employees with 98 or fewer coworkers from this very same threat. He goes on to say the mandate's stated impetus, a purported emergency that the entire globe has now endured for nearly 2 years, and which OSHA itself spent nearly 2 months responding to, is unavailing as well, and its promulgation grossly exceeds OSHA's statutory authority. Now, it doesn't mean that you won't have more federal action, federal judicial action on the matter, a different circuit coming to a different conclusion. It doesn't mean that maybe you won't have federal legislative action in the future if they can't get this through the administrative agencies in which they tried, the Biden administration. But that's where we're at right now. And so, again, the vaccine mandate for those companies that were moving ahead with it, well, now are you going to issue another memo saying compliance with the mandate? It's not just the two jabs. You got to have the booster, too, because that's where we're going, as predicted. I mean, all of the arguments that we've made on this show have come to fruition, and all of the predictions about the next phase for the COVIDians are coming true. And this, again, Tony Fauci saying, yeah, in his estimation, a booster is part of the regimen. You essentially, you're not vaccinated if you don't get the booster.
Right. And the New Mexico governor, that ghastly person, if you're not vaccinated, you're considered unvaccinated unless you have that booster. And again, if you look at your COVID immunization card, there's room for a third shot and room for a fourth shot on that card. So, I mean, I talked to my brother-in-law yesterday, and I said, well, are you going to get the booster shot? Because he's older. Sorry, but he is. And he said, heck no. The government lied and said, you know, get this shot. Get the two shots, and you can take your mask off. And I did what they told me to do, and I'm not getting the booster. I refuse to.
Do you see what happened? And I mean, and now let's talk about the vaccinations generally, too. Yeah. The stories that, you know, won't be covered anywhere else, at least in Chicago, than here. Did you see what happened to that nursing home in Connecticut?
With the 8 cases?
Well, there was a nursing home. You mean deaths?
Deaths.
The nursing and rehab center in Connecticut, which only has 70 residents.
Okay.
And so 70 residents. They had a breakout, 89 total infections. So that would include staff. 87 of those infected were fully vaccinated. And you had 8 people who died at that nursing facility. So 8 of the 87 from underlying, and they had underlying health issues, as right. you would expect in a nursing and rehab.
Right.
But think about that. 87 of the 89 infected were fully vaccinated. 8 died. So the COVID virus whacked more than 10% of the residents despite them being vaccinated, which is about the same as nursing home infections prior to the vaccines. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about case fatality. I'm not just talking about infections. I'm talking about case fatality rates. Isn't it? 10%?
Yeah.
Killing 8 and infecting 87. And this is the path to what? Where?
What? Right. Yeah. Get the booster and then what? Wait for your 4th? You're not going to be freed. You're not going to be unmasked in 5 states that are still masking indoors, and our children aren't going to be set free. I've known so many people, a lot of breakthrough cases of people have been vaccinated that have gotten COVID. But well, those 8 people dying, I mean, that's...
So what are we trying to accomplish again?
We're trying to, some governors and health directors are trying to accomplish zero COVID cases, which is not feasible. It's not going to happen. You cannot eradicate COVID.
We also have this, the data from the Pfizer trials.
Yeah.
Alex Berenson is on the case. I know he's banned on Twitter, but he's still posting at his Substack. Some good stuff here. On July 28th, Pfizer and BioNTech posted a 6-month data update from their key COVID vaccine clinical trial, which is the one that led regulators across the planet to okay the shot. It reported 84% efficacy after 6 months. It also reported that 15 of the roughly 22,000 people who received the vaccine in the trial had died, compared to 14 of the 22,000 people who received a placebo saline shot that didn't contain the vaccine. So 15 of the 22,000 who received the vaccine in the trial died, 14 of the 22,000 who didn't, who received a placebo, died. But they weren't just COVID deaths. In fact, they were mostly not from COVID. Only 3 of the people in the trial died of COVID-related illnesses. Only 3.
Okay.
1 who received the vaccine, 2 who received the saline shot. The other deaths were from other illnesses, mostly cardiovascular. And so that's something to note in and of itself, because the promise of the vaccine is what? I mean, the first promise was you're not going to get COVID.
Right.
You're done with COVID.
And then the second promise is you can't spread it to other people.
Well,
remember that?
Yeah, but transmission. But then they had to do the fallback to serious
right.
illness or death. Well, in the trial,
there was serious illness and death in the trial, what you're saying.
No, I'm saying there was no difference.
Right.
There wasn't serious illness or death. 3 people out of 22,000 died COVID. 1 who had gotten the vaccine, 2 from COVID, 2 who did not.
So it's not effective.
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
312-642-5600, turnkey DEPRO answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
There's also a discrepancy between the FDA's reporting per documents recently released and Pfizer's from that time period. In their initial safety report to the FDA, which contained data through November of 2020, the researchers had said 4 placebo recipients and 2 vaccine recipients died, one after the first dose, one after the second. The July update reversed that trend. Between November 20 and 21, 13 vaccine recipients died compared to only 10 placebo subjects. Further, 9 vaccine recipients had died from cardiovascular events such as heart attacks or strokes compared to 6 placebo recipients who died of those causes. The imbalance, writes Berenson, small but notable, considering regulators across the world found that Pfizer and Moderna RNA vaccines were linked to heart inflammation in young men, thus the warning labels that were slapped on.
Right, that are still there, yes.
Uh-huh. So at best, the results suggest that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, now pushed on nearly a billion people worldwide at a cost of tens of billions of dollars, did nothing to reduce overall deaths. Right?
Yeah, you're right.
I mean,
Alex Berenson's right. Yep.
This is data from their clinical trials.
Right. This is not, yeah.
And this was the basis for the green light. And now we're seeing something like happened at that Connecticut nursing home. Are we sure that the fallback promise prevents serious illness and death any better than a therapeutic in terms of a treatment? Are we sure that's true? I'm asking a question. I think data suggests the question should be yes. I don't know, but this data certainly calls that question to the floor. I mean, it seems to me a legitimate question. And oh, by the way, the FDA has asked a federal judge to make the public wait until the year 2076 to disclose all of the data and information it relied upon to license Pfizer's vaccine.
2076?
55 years.
Because, no, we want to know now. Like, what?
323,000 pages that accompany the Pfizer development trials that accompany the vaccine, mm-hmm. the development of the vaccine, the bringing it to market and getting FDA approval. And FDA is saying, you know, per standards, 500 pages a month. So 500 pages a month, when you have 323,000 pages to disclose, puts it at 2076.
So glad you did the math. And
I mean,
that's insane. You should have a right to that information now.
You almost think this is a joke, but it's not a joke. I mean, now there's a lawsuit that's been filed against the FDA to demand the information.
Good.
Almost 3 months after a licensed Pfizer vaccine, the FDA still has not released a single page per this lawsuit that's been filed.
Oh, my God.
And 2 days ago, the FDA asked a federal judge to give it until 2076 to fully produce the information, to let it produce 329,000 pages of documents at a rate of 500 pages per month. You're sure you want to stake everything you understand to be true, not to mention your health? You want to stake those things on promises from these people? Joe in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Two quick points. You know, number one, I guess Joe Biden might have been correct that the unvaccinated are a threat to the vaccinated because the vaccine doesn't work. And second of all, you know, Amy, at your next press conference, could you just ask a blanket statement to Pritzker and the woman that's in charge of health and just ask them, do you know of any treatments at all for COVID? Do you know of any treatments at all for COVID? Because I'd love to know what their response would be.
Yeah, well, Biden administration plans to buy enough Pfizer anti-COVID pill to treat 10 million people. This new that, you know, they say it's 89% effective in high-risk people to reduce deaths and hospitalizations. Is the government in bed with Pfizer or what? There's other treatments, other therapeutics out there, but then, you know, the government goes and buys 10 million.
By the way, I don't want to get deep in the weeds on this, but there is an unbelievably compelling account of all the studies done on ivermectin. Unbelievably compelling and really detailed. And the top line is the evidence is fairly strong, not fairly strong. The evidence is really strong that ivermectin is an effective therapeutic.
Why is
really
the government
strong.
Buying those, and why are we sticking with Pfizer on everything?
It's just a horse pill. They're taking a horse pill. That's medicine for horses. And then that's it. And I don't want to talk about therapeutics because just put your mask on.
Shut up and get the jab.
That's right. And get the booster, too.
Oh, yeah. Now get the booster. I'm wondering when that's going to come here that you're not considered fully vaccinated until you have the booster. And then you're going to have to deal with, you know, liberal unions here in the state of Illinois and teachers unions and all that. And
by the way, ivermectin, so comparing the vaccine group to the placebo group in those trials, mm-hmm. and the relatively little distinction, in 26 of the 30 studies that have been reviewed here, ivermectin beats the placebo.
Right.
So
then what were we doing?
Yeah, well, so why is that bad? Why do people have to litigate? Why do they have to file lawsuits against hospitals when their doctor wants to prescribe them ivermectin? John in Lincolnwood.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wanted to give everyone some information about this booster shot. I have a friend their husband took the. He was one of those vaccine people. Never left the house. He's fully vaccinated. He got the booster. Had a heart attack that night in bed, unconscious. He had to be revived, and is in the hospital now in intensive care, still unconscious. So I know that it's not going to affect everyone that way, but it's pretty scary that something like that would happen to a 45-year-old guy that is very healthy. You know, it just makes you think, and it's very scary.
Thanks, John. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Well, we're dealing with fundamentally some of the biggest liars in human history. We really are. They've unblinded the studies. I mean, you know that when Pfizer and Moderna, whoever did it, unblinded the studies, I should say, that there's something there. You know, Waterford County, Ireland, 99.5% of the people are vaccinated. They're having a spike. Vermont, 71.8%. They're having a spike. And you know what they're going to do in the future? You know what they're going to do in the future is they're going to say, it doesn't matter if everybody gets vaccinated. What they're going to say is, you weren't vaccinated early enough.
That's what
they'll say. The people who are like us, who don't go and follow everything that they want, if everybody was forced to, they'd still discriminate against you by doing that. That's what they would do. I've read Gulag by Anne Applebaum. I know how this stuff goes. And on my train ride to the Kolyma gold mines, that's what it's going to say on mine, that I didn't vaccinate early enough.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Judge Bruce Schroeder, he's the presiding judge in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, made some off-the-cuff remarks during a hearing for the latest motion to dismiss, for a mistrial from the defense over a discrepancy on video evidence that the prosecution presented at trial. But a different version was given to the defense, and they claimed that it would have changed how they approached handling that evidence during the trial. But listen to Judge Schroeder on the media's role in the Rittenhouse trial.
We're there in part, not fully, but in part, because of grossly irresponsible handling of what comes out of this trial. I will tell you this. I'm going to think long and hard about live television of a trial again next time. I don't know. I've always been a firm believer in it because I think the people should be able to see what's going on. But when I see what's being done, it's really quite frightening. Frightening, that's the right word for it.
Yeah, because the media is going after him, too, from his ringtone to the fact that, you know, he had Rittenhouse pick the jurors out of a box, which is what they do in Wisconsin.
The claim being made by the media leftists is that if Rittenhouse is acquitted, it's because the judge was in the tank for the defense. That's the sum total of it. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by William Jacobson. He's a clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School. He's also the founder of the excellent blog, legalinsurrection.com, and he's president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation. Professor Jacobson, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on.
What about what Judge Schroeder had to say about, you know, sort of, he didn't get into too much detail, you have, the media's role in how the public understands this trial?
Well, it's similar to so many other cases. The media immediately sets a narrative which is hostile to the defendant in a highly politicized case. Happened in the George Zimmerman case, has happened in multiple cases. And you can't get rid of that narrative. So the narrative is Kyle Rittenhouse is a militia member who crossed state lines with a weapon to shoot peaceful protesters. None of those things are true, other than he did cross a state line. Like, that's some big deal nowadays. But he wasn't carrying a weapon. The weapon was already in Wisconsin. He was lawfully able to possess it in Wisconsin. That's why the judge threw out the charge of being a minor in possession. He wasn't a militia member. There's certainly no evidence introduced of that. And he didn't shoot peaceful protesters. He shot three extremely violent people who tried to kill him. But that media narrative is out there. It will never go away. And that has framed the case for political purposes, that this is white supremacy on trial here. So you have Black Lives Matter protesters out there claiming racism for a white kid who shot three white people. Has nothing to do with race, yet that's what it's turned into. And because of that, this has become a cause célèbre for the left, that this kid needs to be convicted. And the facts, though, show that it was clearly self-defense. I don't know what's taking the jury so long. Hopefully it's not a sign that they're going to convict him, because the evidence is just absolutely overwhelming that this was self-defense.
But the jurors live in the community, obviously. And do you think that they're afraid of what's going to happen? You know, what happened the last time with their town burning down, and that would, you know, cloud their judgment?
Well, they might deny it, but I think it's hanging over. It's hanging over just like it was in the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, where there were, armed troops surrounding the courthouse. How can that not influence a juror? Where there was, in the George Floyd case, a congresswoman calling for riots and protests if there's a not guilty verdict. And the same thing is happening here. At least I don't believe any, congressmen have made that claim. But, he's been called a white supremacist by the president, now president of the United States. So this has to be hanging on the jurors, that they know if there's a not guilty. They come to court. They probably see the protesters outside. They are not sequestered. Protesters outside the courtroom with courthouse with bullhorns. They've got to hear this. They've got to know what's going to happen. They might say it's not going to impact them, but the mere fact that they'd be thinking about it has to have an effect on things.
Well, I can understand why the pro-looter crowd, looting is symbolic taking, as Nicole Hannah-Jones characterizes it. I can understand, because they're used to being able to force politicians to capitulate or expose the cowardice of politicians who do capitulate and direct their police force to stand down when cities are laid siege to, as happened all over America last year, including in Kenosha. And so they don't like when a private citizen takes it upon himself to do what the civilian political authorities won't do, in a sense, to try to protect private property and to try to protect private citizens. But it seems to me that if Rittenhouse were convicted based on the arguments, as muddled as they were, offered by the prosecution, that would be a serious precedent in diminishment of people's understanding of self-defense and their likelihood to defend themselves.
I think that's absolutely true. If you can't defend yourself when someone's beating you in the head with a skateboard, if you can't defend yourself when they're running at you while you're on the ground and they lower their Glock pistol towards your head from 3 feet away, if you can't defend yourself when someone who's already that night threatened to kill you if he caught you alone and is now reaching for your gun, if you can't defend yourself in those circumstances and the full weight of the state and the full weight of the media is going to come down on you, then we are in a really bad place. And I think that's why the left and the media, which are one and the same, have focused so heavily on this. They do not want people to be able to defend themselves. They want to defund the police. They want to let mobs run the streets, and they don't want citizens to be able to defend themselves. That's what this case has become.
Yeah, I mean, lest we forget, you know, former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, it was just a couple of years ago, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times calling for the repeal of the Second Amendment. And, of course, that's the operative position of the entire collection of the left.
That's what this is all about, and that's why they're so heavily focused on it. You don't see this sort of media attention for other cases that don't involve self-defense, don't involve what they perceive to be a racial element, even though there is none here. That's what this is all about. This is about citizens not being able to defend themselves because the police are nowhere to be found. They were nowhere to be found during the rioting in Kenosha. They were on the edges. Everybody was left for themselves. And there were violent, violent people like this multiple child rapist, Joseph Rosenbaum, who got shot. So when he tried to grab Kyle Rittenhouse's gun, this violent, violent person who has a long criminal history and was out looking to beat people that night. So, you know, those people are allowed to run the streets. Those people won't be arrested. But somebody who defends themselves against those criminals is going to get arrested. And that's the way the left wants it. They want people intimidated. They want them cowed into fear. They want them to be able to be manipulated. And that's why this case has become so important.
And have you noticed that Rosenbaum's family and Huebner's family, they're not in the courtroom. They're not talking to reporters saying, you know, Rittenhouse killed my child or killed my son or killed, you know, my brother, that they've remained pretty much silent during this whole process.
Well, you know, everybody's entitled to, you know, protection of the criminal laws, even a criminal like Rosenbaum. But, you know, the world is a better place that child rapist, violent person is not in it. And he was killed lawfully. He doesn't deserve to be killed unlawfully, but he was killed while trying to kill somebody else.
And the other argument that's been made by op-ed writers of the left and so forth, you know, Rittenhouse, he shouldn't have been there. He had no business being there. Well, first of all, whether he should or shouldn't have been there is immaterial to whether or not he defended himself under the law. But secondly, so he is not allowed to go to Kenosha and protect private property. But those that descended on Kenosha from all over the country, they're perfectly within their rights to do so.
That's where we are in society right now, is that looters are more protected than the people who protect property and protect themselves.
Yeah, and I'm so sick of the whole thing. You know, he crossed state lines, too. He worked in Kenosha, well, Mount Pleasant at the rec center there, as a lifeguard. It's in his dad lived there. So, I, you know, people in New York, don't you go to New Jersey a lot? You know, it's not like it's a big deal to go 10 minutes away.
You know, I live in Rhode Island. I can't throw a stone without crossing a state line because we're so small. This notion, how hysterical is this? The people who want open borders on the Mexican border, all of a sudden, you know, the sanctity of the border between Illinois and Wisconsin. How ridiculous is this?
Wisconsin should build a wall for a lot of reasons. But I want to get your take on something else, too. These continuing revelations per the Merrick Garland memo. About parents at school board members being a matter of concern for federal law enforcement. Well, now we have a development, not just a memo indicating that EDU officials file has been set up within the FBI and counterterrorism group, in addition to another division within the Department of Justice, are, you know, actively soliciting potential cases. That's number one. Number two, we have Southlake, Texas, the U.S. Education Department's civil rights enforcement arm investigating allegations of discrimination at the Carroll Independent School in Southlake, Texas. For people who forgot, Southlake, Texas was all the rage before Loudoun County was, with a fight over critical race theory in the curriculum. And they turned over their school board in Southlake, Texas, and got rid of all the school board members who were promoting critical race theory as part of the curriculum. And now that school and that school board are being investigated by the Education Department.
you know, one of the things that scares Democrats more than anything is this parents movement, because it is a multiracial movement. It crosses political lines. It is a parents movement. So they have been unsuccessful in stopping it by doing their usual tactics of falsely calling people racist, et cetera, et cetera. That hasn't worked. That hasn't slowed it down. So now they have brought in the heavy artillery. They have they're trying to designate this movement as domestic terrorists. That's the term that the National School Board Association used to in their letter to the FBI. The FBI jumped on it within 4 days, which almost certainly means it was pre-planned. Nobody moves that quickly. It just doesn't happen. Somebody writes a letter to the FBI or to the Department of Justice, and all of a sudden, the FBI is on the case. That doesn't happen, particularly where there's been no actual violence. What we're talking about are, you know, the sort of unfortunate threats that happen whenever anybody enters the political realm. But there's been no violence at these school boards. The only violence that's happened is occasionally someone will get upset when their microphone is cut off or something like that, and they're usually just escorted out by local police. There's no need for the federal government to be involved other than to intimidate people. And that's exactly what Merrick Garland, who should resign. He's unfit to be attorney general. Thank God he's not on the Supreme Court. He needs to resign because he has been a participant in the use of the FBI and the Department of Justice for political intimidation. Everybody knows it.
He is Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School, founder of LegalInsurrection.com and president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation. Professor Jacobson, thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. McClure Junior High in Western Springs. Junior High, you know, 7th and 8th graders.
Yeah. Normally 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, yeah. What is going on with the...
Not at McClure, 7th and 8th graders.
Okay, Dan, got it. McClure.
We take pride in all our Bulldogs, become a McActivist at McClure. A club for 7th and 8th graders, meets every other week starting in late October. Questions ask Miss Kelly or Miss Knob. A safe space to discuss topics that concern you. Friends, parents, middle school, high school, anything. Participate in student and mentor-led discussions, book talks, games, service projects, activities. Talk and learn about social justice, LGBTQIA+, BLM, etc. Get involved and create a community of your own. Make a positive impact on our school climate. Discuss topics of concern, including their parents. You want your 7th and 8th grader going to Miss Kelly or Miss Knob to address issues they have with you? Miss Kelly and Miss Knob, is that their job? Is that the teacher's job? I mean, I understand it in an abusive situation, but let's get beyond those small number of matters of a child being abused and she turns to a teacher or school official or police officer or whatever. I'm talking generally speaking here, the culture that's being created. Is that what? Is that right? Social justice issues combined with concerns you have, talk to them, including about your parents. Any concerns from parents about that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Miss Kelly's a science teacher. Miss Knob teaches math. Are these trained psychologists or psychiatrists, social workers? No. BLM, LGBTQIA+. Any concern about that? Any concern about what's going on in the schools we talk a lot about high school. We talk something about the primary grades, but you know, all throughout your K through 12 education, you think this is all just, you know, on the up and up? A skeptical eye, is that warranted here, or am I making too much of it? Amy, care to comment or no?
I'm trying to figure out this story. So there, this club is only being offered to 7th and 8th graders at this junior high middle school, correct? And they're telling them exactly...
McClure Junior High is only 7th and 8th grade for the third time.
In Western Springs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, let's try Brian in Oak Forest. Brian, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, what's up? Real quick. Check out Mayor Keith Peekow's Facebook post from yesterday. He's the only one in town that has any stones. I guess District 135 in Orland is canceling Christmas and anything that has the word saint in front of it. So give that a look. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Sure. Yeah.
Cancel Christmas? Oh, wait, we're going to celebrate Kwanzaa now, but not Christmas. Okay.
It's too limiting. It's not inclusive enough. This is all of a kind of what's happening in schools here. You know, we're in the middle, I don't know if you know, of Transgender Awareness Week.
I did not know that.
Yeah, well, you got to keep up with these
things.
Well,
what color is associated with it, Dan? And is there a ribbon involved?
Well, like Kraft, the corporation, for Trans Awareness Week, we want to make our world more inclusive. So we're releasing a book with our friend Nick North about the importance of using the proper pronouns. Yeah. Because when we stick together, hashtag, we're better. For Trans Awareness Week, Crunchy and Smoothie are being presented by Kraft Peanut Butter to build a more inclusive and better world. Crunch, that'll probably be assigned reading. Maybe that'll be part of that social justice club at McClure Junior High in Western Springs. What do you think? You know, what we sanitize the language. We're not strong enough, accurate enough with what's happening. There's a good piece by Garry Kasparov, the chess master, human rights activist, in the Wall Street Journal on this, that woke is a bad word for the real threat to democracy. Knows a little bit about this, being a Soviet dissident, you'll recall as well. The search is on for new words for old ideas. Cancel culture and woke have become overused and abused. Part of a struggle to define one's political opponents in the harshest possible way, to dismiss ideas as not only wrong or harmful, but intolerable. As a non-native English speaker, I'm content to avoid rhetorical fashion and use older phrases, call it mob mentality, groupthink, or punitive neo-Puritan orthodoxy. And, you know, Kasparov is sort of a man of the left. But what he says is what's actually happening, which is more accurate. We know this, but we should use the terminology. Vengeance and coercion. Vengeance and coercion in the place of justice and reason. They're not woke. They're vengeful. They're coercive. They're thugs. They're goons. They're anti-intellectual monsters, really. And those are the values that are replacing justice and reason. That's what's actually happening, you know, trying to define what woke is. I saw some of this on some MSNBC. You know, it was on The View of all places.
Right. Oh, I thought I watched that, not you. You're watching The View now?
Yeah, I got one clip from a Lincoln Project hack.
Oh, they put her on again.
What is woke? What does that really even mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means the person is a vengeful, coercive goon. That's what it means. It means a person is anti-reason, is anti-justice, is a thug, is a monster. That's what it means. Are we getting closer? You know, Garry Kasparov said, I've seen this before. Yeah, no doubt he's seen it before in the Soviet Union. And again, earlier this week, we had a clip from an artist, a Chinese artist, who's a dissident. So he's to the Chinese communists what Kasparov was to the Soviet communists. And Ai Weiwei had this to say.
In your book, you're describing the directives of Mao Zedong during the Cultural Revolution that would be distributed publicly every night. And then you write, this is your quote, They served a function similar to Donald Trump's late night tweets while in office. They were the direct communication of a leader's thoughts to his devoted followers, enhancing the sanctity of his authority. So, do you see Donald Trump as an authoritarian?
If you're authoritarian, you have to have a system in supporting you. You cannot just be authoritarian by yourself. But certainly in United States, with today's condition, you can easily have an authoritarian. In many ways, you're already in the authoritarian state. You just don't know it.
How so?
Many things happens today in U.S. can be compared to Cultural Revolution in China.
Like what?
Like people trying to be unified in certain political correctness. That is very dangerous.
Right. And the key phrase, as we talked about, was you can't be an authoritarian by yourself. You need systemic power. And that's what these vengeful, coercive thugs have in K-12 school systems and in all of the other civic and cultural institutions in our country.
And those two teachers in McClurg, they're both the basketball coaches as well, whatever. They teach, one teaches math, one teaches science. They have no business intruding into your home life. I mean, you go to them, yes, if you're having a problem at home or you're getting beaten or something horrible is happening, yes, the school is there for you. But besides that, it's not the government's business to ask you. They're not therapists. They shouldn't ask you about how your home life is doing.
Maurice and Berwyn.
But, guys, I know there is a definitely kind of a stigma which child approach when it comes to education now. But there are absolutely times where a kid does not feel comfortable going to their parents about certain things. And sometimes an adult is just encouraging a kid to say, hey, let's go to your parents about that. And maybe they will understand. Kids are terrified to talk to their parents about things they've done.
But that wasn't the suggestion in the flyer. The suggestion was you talk about problems with your parents.
Right, the problem is just the communication. Like, let's not just kind of take it and run with it.
So I
want people to be open to that they may just be going to them saying, hey, my parents are this way, I have this issue, and I don't like them. And they may just say, hey, just try this and go into them with this issue.
A lot of times kids don't want to,
and sometimes people in schools may say, let's go and talk to them about this. I know that we're fearful of education and what they're doing. I get that. I get you guys' point. I'm not fighting you.
No, I hear you, but here's the thing. I don't think they deserve the benefit of the doubt anymore as institutions. You want to give them the benefit of the doubt and take this in a way that this is innocently constructed. And particularly when you connect that one statement to the fact that this is learning about social justice issues, BLM and LGBTQ, et cetera, I have a feeling that what's going on in that group and what the purpose of that group is to separate kids from their parents, which is the purpose of all of these cultural Marxist gambits in K-12 education, in college and elsewhere. So I can't look at those two and say, oh, they're disconnected. That's just happenstance that it's social justice issues and these identitarian political groups talk to us about your parents.
I understand that's the last point. But when we stop giving people the benefit of the doubt, guys, certain things happen. Meet me in the middle. It's okay. I'm in the middle. There's a lot of room here for us in the middle. It's a big chance.
I hear you, Maurice. Thanks for the call.
And again,
I hear you.
Yeah, the flyer said a safe space to discuss topics that concern you. Friends, parents, middle school, high school, anything! Exclamation point.
There's another word on that flyer. It's the headline.
Because we take pride in all our Bulldogs, McActivists.
McActivists. McActivists. Is that what the purpose is of K-12 education? To turn kids into activists? Activists, to talk to us about your parents, learn about BLM and other left identitarian groups.
Yeah, I don't even know what LGBTQIA plus.
That should be taken innocently? Sorry, I don't think so. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, you guys. Here on that, what Maurice was saying, if teachers should be more involved with their kids over at McClure. My daughter went to McClure. Oh. The teachers, if they're seeing anything, or they want to, I mean, if there's something wrong with the kid that they got to go, or they're worried about a kid, the teacher should contact the parents. Okay, that's just a social part about it. You know, what Maurice was saying, kids are afraid to talk to their parents, blah, blah, blah. If the teachers were more aware about what, you know, they should pay attention to the kids they're worried about and contact the parents. All right, and it's Gender Awareness Week. Is that what you guys said?
No, trans Awareness Week.
Trans. Good. Okay, here's something to read. A publication from Hillsdale College called Imprimis. It's
Imprimis.
Written by a woman.
Right.
Imprimis. Yeah. Oh, sorry, you're aware of this then, but I'm reading this thing called Gender Ideology Run Amok. It was published in April of 2021. So look up Abigail Shire, S-H-R-I-E-R. We wrote a piece called Individual Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Very interesting and good read. So I'll recommend that, and I'll copy it and pass it out to people, because then we'll know what LGBTQTPSABCD plus means.
Plus. Don't forget the plus.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Yeah, Abigail Shire wrote a book on it. She was delisted from Amazon. Right. We've had her on the show to talk about her book. Carolyn Moments.
Hi. Good morning, guys. I was kind of wondering when they're going to bring out the little uniform for these kids, you know, maybe a little brown shirt, and then they could have something standing for super school. It could be a SS emblem on their shoulders, and, you know, they can go from there, and then they can talk about their parents and all of that, and then they can have people follow up with the parents at their houses.
Thanks for the call, Carol. Yeah, I get where you're going. Julian Bloomington.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think the nugget sometimes that's being covered up by things that look like this is education is pretty adamant about removing parents from the equation. And that's just my personal opinion as a mother and as a middle school teacher in Central Illinois. And I've had multiple situations probably in the last 6 or 7 years with my own children. And if anybody's gone to a parent-teacher conference in the last 6 or 7 years, you'll walk in and your kid presents a slideshow to you on their own computer. You don't actually sit down and talk with the teacher. And the times that I have trying to advocate for one of my children, they will talk to my child sitting right there in the meeting, and they will not speak to me. I'm like,
that's ridiculous.
I'm a colleague of yours. I teach with you. And as I've, you know, as the kids have gotten older, we've had situations where a friend of mine, so my children go to the schools that I teach in. So it's a little bit different. But they've had situations where a child maybe was sharing with my daughter, I think I'm of self-harming. Okay, well, I happen to know the mother of this child, and so I reach out to the mother. The school social worker, who is a colleague, comes to me, reads me the Riot Act. How dare you contact the parent? You need to be contacting me. And I said, again, who do you think you are that you trump a parent? But this shows up all the time in that the parents are almost left out, just like the LGBTQ issue I actually spoke to you all about a few months ago. You would call the parent, the teacher says to me. You would call the parent? How could you call the parent? I'm an advocate in that child's life. They should be, I'm a trusted adult. They should be coming to me, not the parent. So I'm not sure, even as a teacher, where this little nugget was born. But as a mother and as a teacher, I see it all the time. And so I don't know if that's their way, the beginnings of indoctrination or whatever you want to call it. But it's real, and it's everywhere, that the parents, it used to be, you know, when we were kids, the parents were very involved in grades, involved in discipline, involved in planning what's best for the kid. Now, forget about it.
Thanks for the call, Julia. Appreciate that perspective, particularly as a teacher. Trans Awareness Week. One New Hampshire teenager is very aware of Trans Awareness Week. He's suing his school district, Exeter High School, not Phillips Exeter, the boarding school, but Exeter High School, the public school there in New Hampshire, suing a school district after he was suspended from the football team for a game because he said there are only two genders.
Oh, please.
That's Trans Awareness Week. That's building
a
better
world. It's
the civil
rights movement of our time, Dan.
That's inclusion and tolerance. That's what we're talking about. And I'm sure his parents weren't consulted about this before the decision was rendered either, because, as Julie was saying, the point is to cut them out. The point is to cut them out. This parents' rights movement that has sprung up organically around the country is because parents are experiencing exactly what Julia from Bloomington said. Exactly. And this this play at McClure Junior High in Western Springs and so many like it are not innocent. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This coming Saturday, November 20th, this Saturday, there's a workshop for election judges, or an election judge workshop, actually, for Chicago police. Begins at 12:30 p.m. It's being hosted at Trump International Hotel downtown.
Nice.
And the sponsor is Scott Casper, who is an attorney. He was a candidate for Orland Township Supervisor. And he's also the chairman and founder of Responsibility in Government. He joins us now. Scott, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me here.
So the impetus for this election judge workshop specifically for Chicago police.
So it's Chicago area police. You know, the general public is invited to attend as well, but it's free for police, and we're, you know, it's free parking for police, and there's going to be free food for police. Well, free food for everyone, really. But it's a free event for police.
You're not going to get police there without free food, that's for sure.
So I learned that through marketing, that, you know, you have to emphasize the free. So
right, no, but why are you doing this? Like, what's the – why just focusing on retired police officers from Chicago and surrounding suburbs?
Sure. Well, active and retired. You know, police have been through the ringer the last 2 years, really. You know, whether it be, I don't know if I want to call it a movement, but the defund the police movement, or you know, the vaccine mandates. And you know, I have police friends who are really kind of worked up. And, you know, and when they complain to me, I say, well, get involved in the system. I'm like, do something about it. And they say, what, I run for mayor? Say, okay, well, maybe that's a little bit too much. But what you can do is get involved in the electoral process, and you can become an election judge and an election observer. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense for a police officer, you know, retired or active, to become an election judge. You know, every day they're enforcing the law. Every day they're dealing with confronting situations and de-escalating situations. And these skills translate, you know, directly to the role, the important role of an election judge.
I've actually, in the campaigns I've run, particularly in Cook County or statewide, that necessarily means you have to deal with Cook County, have hired dozens, in some cases hundreds, of retired, sometimes retired, but off-duty police officers to serve as poll watchers, as you say, election observers, specifically poll watchers, because we know the areas and we know the precincts throughout Cook County and throughout the state where they're are always problems, and you know, having a cop there with a gun, seriously,
really?
And a badge, that's part of any sensible election or ballot integrity program, particularly for Republicans in Cook County in Illinois. As far as I'm concerned, it's something I've done. Sure. I'm not the only one who's done it, but it's something that the Republican Party has failed to do. Have ballot integrity programs generally. But specifically including police. So I love the idea, and I love the focus on police, because they do bring a sense of authority and law enforcement to polling places. And that's not a bad thing in the areas we're talking about.
No, it's not a bad thing. And you mentioned a good point. They know their precincts better than anyone. They know how to interact with, you know, with a wide variety of people and personalities. So it's really, you know, they're trained to do that. So it's really, I think it's a wonderful part of the solution. Cook County has a chronic problem of not enough election judges. There should be 5 election judges in every precinct. There should be at least 2 from each party. And oftentimes there's not. Oftentimes there's vacancies and they get filled by things like students. And not that that's horrible, but we can do better.
Well, and I wonder if your experience running for office is in some way informing this effort you've undertaken.
It is, you know, it is to an extent. I went through the process of running for local election, and I mean, honestly, for years prior to that, I just, you know, I voted by absentee. So my eyes were opened during that process of, you know, of especially early voting, being out in front of the polling place for 2 weeks straight. You know, you see how it really runs, and there's, you know, it's, I think it's fair to say that in Cook County especially, there's room for improvement.
You think?
Well, yeah, that is an understatement.
I think police officers really could be an important part to, you know, that solution.
And forgive my ignorance, but they can wear their uniforms. I mean, if they're
not
still
uniforms.
Active police officers, well, they can't wear their uniforms.
Not in uniform; they're off duty.
Okay,
right. They would be off duty.
Yeah.
And how many people have signed up for it so far?
We have over 100, and we have room for, well, we have a ton of room. It's at Trump Tower, but you know, we still have room, so we're still accepting registrations, and I think it's going to be a very exciting day. We have, you know, a keynote speaker is Bernard Kierick, the 40th Police Commissioner of New York City, the Commissioner on 9/11, and you know, cops love that guy. I think he'll be a good draw. Apparently, he has something to say about election integrity as well, which will be helpful. But he's just planning on. You know, meeting with Chicago cops and you know, motivating them to take this step, this important step, and become election judges.
Yeah, I think, you know, you talked about this being eye-opening. I'd probably be less eye-opening for a lot of the police there, but for any resident that wants to show up from Chicagoland area too, it may be eye-opening to understand exactly how elections are actually administered. Obviously, if you go to the polls, you see some of it, but I don't think you get a full appreciation for it. And again, in highly competitive districts where there's a lot of money and a lot of manpower, I mean, the other side, I know this is nonpartisan, but the other side, the Democrats, socialists, they have unions, the public sector unions. And you go to polling places in hotly contested areas and you'll see their people 3, 4, 5 deep. Passing in front of the polling place. I mean, legitimately, but nonetheless, and sometimes not so legitimately, but there are legitimate things they can do, but they have a presence there. And that presence is impactful, particularly when you understand that most survey research suggests that about 1 in 6 voters make their decision on particular races as they're going into the polling place. That's how late they decide. And which is why sometimes there can be movement right up until the polls close.
No, it's true. And you mentioned the public sector unions. You know, a lot of teachers will sign up to be election judges. And I've had great teachers in my life, so I'm not gonna say that that automatically may be a disqualifier because they're likely to be aligned with the Democratic Party. But what will happen a lot of times is a teacher will bring, especially like a high school or college professor, will bring students with, and the students are there for, you know, to earn extra credit. And you would like to believe those students are acting independently, but, you know, let's be honest, there's always going to be that teacher-student relationship going on. And, you know, I just think we can do better. And you know, thank you for pointing out this is a nonpartisan event. The organization I've started, Responsibility in Government, is a 501c4. So we're required to be nonpartisan. And, you know, I don't know about you, but even if a police officer is a strong Democrat, I would be much more comfortable having that person as an election judge than most anyone else, because I know they've taken an oath and I know they take their job seriously, and enforcing the law is what they do.
Yeah, and also, I mean, to some extent, too, I mean, there's the skullduggery piece of it, and then there's just the ignorance piece of it. And so you'll have election judges have experienced this, where they won't let a poll watcher see who's voted, for example. And that's and the poll watcher with a properly credentialed is entitled to see who's voted. It is entitled to check in and see who's voted, you know, think about like after the morning rush and before the evening rush and so on and so forth, because that's part of a get out the vote program. And both parties are entitled to do it. And both parties are entitled to see, and they've got their lists oftentimes if they're well organized. And so they know, okay, well, you know, our plus voters, these plus voters have voted as of 10 a.m. and these plus voters haven't. So we better you know, send our door knockers out or make phone calls to these voters and starts to winnow the list during the day. That's part of legitimate campaigns, legitimate election operations, legitimate get out the vote efforts as part of those elections. And sometimes you just have election judges that don't understand that a credentialed poll watcher is entitled to see something like that.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And they're entitled, you know, the poll watchers are entitled to watch the verification process and the challenge signatures. And, and having an election judge who knows that they have those rights as well and is going to look out to, you know, to protect their rights is important. We all know that some election judges, and maybe they're ignorant and maybe this is intentional or maybe a combination of both, but, you know, they will go to great lengths to make the poll watchers have a rough time. You know, they'll put them in, you know, in the corner behind the table where they can't really see very well. And having an election judge who's above board, who's going to be looking out for the rights of everyone in the room, including the right of the voter to be able to cast a ballot. So, I just think this having, you know, having police as election judges resolve so many of these issues.
It's such a great idea. And how can people who haven't signed up and want to sign up, where can they go?
So if you go to responsibilityingovernment.com, you'll see there's a whole bunch of information about the event. And from there, you can click to register. You can register for, you know, if you're a police officer, retired or active, or anyone in law enforcement, you can register for a free ticket. There's general public tickets that are $20. And we also have VIP tickets because we're doing a special dinner afterwards with Bernie Kierick, so you can sign up for those as well. But it's all at responsibilityingovernment.com.
All right. He is Scott Casper, the founder of Responsibility in Government, responsibilityingovernment.com, as we get more information on this event on Saturday at 12:30 at the Trump Hotel downtown. Election judge workshop for Chicagoland police and residents, as he was describing, nonpartisan in nature. Scott, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the event on Saturday.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Thank God for these never Trump turncoat Republicans. Thank goodness for them, because they're doing conservatives' bidding at present. A case study in that is the Lincoln Project's Tara Settmayer. You know, Lincoln Project was the sort of phony baloney effort by a bunch of never Trump Republicans, in quotation marks, to really enrich themselves while pretending to stand on principle against Trump's excesses. A bunch of Republicans, good card carrying Republicans.
It wasn't one of the founders molested somebody?
Yeah, John Weaver, sexual predator. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, real upstanding citizen.
Good, solid, middle of the road, McCain, W Republicans, right? It's funny. Once they went south on Trump, they went south on so many other issues too that have nothing to do with Trump. Isn't it interesting? Mm-hmm. So now they're roll call votes for the left on so many issues. Our own outgoing Congressman Adam Kinzinger being a nice exhibit of that. It's Trump votes for the Dem Socialist Green New Deal 1.0, votes for this ridiculous carnival censure against Arizona Republican Paul Gosar because he tweeted some anime video about AOC. Who cares? But of course, he and, by the way, Liz Cheney, the other of the two Republicans who voted with a Democrat Socialist to censure Gosar.
Of course she did.
They fall right in line and all sorts of other issues, fiscal, cultural, the 1-6 business with Kinzinger and his crocodile tears, all of that. Once they're over on Trump, then they're free to fully embrace the entire Democrat socialist agenda, which is what most of them are doing. Tara Settmayer on The View talking about critical race theory.
We at the Lincoln Project pointed that out in the Virginia race, that critical race theory is the new N-word for Republicans in the Southern strategy in 2021. Yes. But Democrats have to have a good comeback to this, or they will lose in 2022. Okay. Unfortunately, that's the reality.
Critical race theory is the N-word for the new N-word for Republicans. It's the Southern strategy. They opposed Glenn Youngkin for governor of Virginia. But they're good, middle-of-the-road, commonsensical Republicans. Love it. Keep talking, Tara. And by the way, keep using that exact phraseology, because it's not what the DCCC wants their allies to be saying. They're trying to figure out what to say on these curriculum issues amid this organic parents' rights movement that has sprung up in response to these authoritarians in K-12 education. Chris Taylor, who's a DCCC spokesman, Democrat Congressional Campaign Committee, said, gave you an indication of what they want the message to be, and talking to Business Insider. House Democrats safely reopened schools, deliver tax relief and the child tax credit, and we're fighting for universal pre-K and paid family leave. Republicans stand in opposition to American families. Our bet heading into 2022 is that voters will choose progress over division. Well, saying that anybody who raises concerns about critical race theory and indoctrination in K-12 is just a cover for their racism. Well, that will work out nationally about as well as it did in Virginia a couple of Tuesdays ago. For more on the topic, pleased to be joined by hotair.com senior editor Ed Morrissey. Ed, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
I'm loving the Lincoln Project more with each passing day.
Yeah, it's a gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? I mean, these guys just really can't seem to get out of their own way. I'm surprised they still have money left. I thought everybody had paid off all of their mortgages. So I'm surprised that they still have money left. Apparently, they've still got some.
And it also seems like the Dems are still struggling with exactly how to respond, because they're not going to relent. They can't. So they're going to try to sideline that as an issue. But as long as you have parents experiencing what parents in Loudoun and Fairfax County and South Lake Texas and all over the country are experiencing, you're not going to be able to make that go away, because there's a lot of parents that are really invested and perhaps paying more attention than they ever did about their kids' education.
Well, I think they should, right? I mean, that's part of why you have school boards that are elected by the parents and the voters in those districts, is because you want the school boards to be accountable to the parents and to the voters. That's the reason why you have school board meetings, is for accountability. And the idea that you're going to replace that with self-appointed experts and cut off parents' access to curriculum is antithetical to the entire model of school boards. I mean, this is so basic. It's amazing to me that it's escaped people's notice. What they're describing, what Terry McAuliffe was describing, was basically the elimination of school boards as entities entirely. You don't need a school board if the superintendent and the principals are just simply going to adopt the curriculum without any input from parents whatsoever. Why do you have a school board at all? Just hire a superintendent.
The other issue that they're going to say doesn't exist, and in the most acerbic terms possible, Sarah Jong is a former editorial board member of the New York Times, incredibly. Harvard law grad. Not incredibly. Actually, it turns out that a lot of Harvard grads, the students who gain entrance into Harvard, are legacies or quota fillers. And it turns out that they don't get much of an education at Harvard either. Sarah Jong's writing is certainly proof of that. She's still an opinion contributor for the New York Times. She wrote, quote, tweeted, "All the stuff you see about inflation in the news is driven by rich people flipping their blank because their parasitic assets aren't doing as well as they'd like, and they're scared that unemployment benefits plus stimulus checks plus $15 minimum wage plus labor shortage is why." Huh. Well,
I mean, it's just nonsense. Yeah. I mean, first off, inflation is a tax on the poor. It's not a tax on the rich.
Right.
The rich can withstand inflation. It's the poor and it's people on fixed incomes, and there's usually, somewhat overlap on those things, and then retirees who pay the price for inflation. So it's not the wealthy who are going to be feeling the pain of inflation. It's going to be people who are not.
Right. And the idea that you're going to, I mean, that argument is so elitist and so blinkered to reality that it is really a self-indictment.
Well, it's somebody else who never passed an Econ 101 course. But by the way, inflation, right. That's helped people who hold equities. That's helped home prices for now. So the parasitic assets, who's getting hammered, to your point, are people who are price sensitive when it comes to filling up their tank or buying groceries.
You know, there's a new Quinnipiac poll that came out today and said that 68% of Americans have had to change their shopping decisions, their buying decisions, based on inflation. 68%. That's not the wealthy.
No.
That's not the elite who are feeling that pain. That's people who, like you just said, Dan, are driving up to the pump every day.
Yeah, but I mean, President Biden's just now realizing that inflation is an actual thing. It took him what, more than a month to figure this out?
Took him months. I mean, this was we were sort of raising the flag on this back in the early summer, late spring, and Larry Summers wrote about it in February before they even passed that third COVID relief stimulus bill. He warned that it was too much and it was going to generate an inflationary wave. And the White House basically told Larry Summers that he was an idiot. And Paul Krugman said that Larry Summers was an idiot. And it turns out that Paul Krugman and Joe Biden are the idiots, and Larry Summers was right. And I'm not even a big Larry Summers fan, but it's on record. He wrote about it in the Washington Post in February, saying that that they were making a big mistake, that they were putting far too much money into stimulus.
And let's move on to, you know, Rittenhouse trial, because in a few minutes they're about to start their third day of deliberations. Whatever happened to the defense's request for a mistrial with prejudice?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of interesting because, you know, the judge says, well, the state hasn't had a chance to respond to this, but, you know, the defense actually raised this not the day that the jury went into deliberations. They raised it a couple days earlier, and based on the exchange over the right to remain silent that took place during Rittenhouse's cross-examination of Rittenhouse, and so this thing's been floating around for a bit. Now, I've watched a little bit of the trial, not a ton of it, and it seems to me that Judge Schroeder is really just trying to get this thing to a jury, right? He doesn't want to be seen as intervening here. He wants the process to play out. And what I'm guessing is that he's holding this in abeyance until he hears what the jury has to say. And maybe the jury just makes it a moot point. But, you know, the longer this thing stretches on, the less confident I am that they're going to look at this as a, you know, complete self-defense case.
Well, here again, and the identitarian left's commentary on Rittenhouse from the president on down, and it continues to the present. Cori Bush, one of the newly minted socialist Spice Girls, tweeting, "When we marched in Ferguson, white supremacists would hide behind a hill near where Michael Brown was murdered, oh, and shoot at us. They never face consequences. If Kyle Rittenhouse gets acquitted, it tells them that even 7 years later, they still can get away with it." So this is a referendum on white supremacy, according to Cori Bush. That's going to play well.
Well, not only that, but I mean, it's a lie. I mean, the police department there said nobody was shooting at them from any place. The only people that got shot at were police during those marches. There were two police officers shot. So the whole thing is a lie. It's something that she made up. Cori Bush is a demagogue. And look, I mean, she's very successful at being a demagogue, but that's all she is. And I think that Democrats who fall in line behind that are setting themselves up for a massive, massive failure. The Virginia shows that I think that voters have really had enough of this type of ethnic determinism and the poisonous effect it has on people trying to work together and live together.
Now, the midterms are still a year away, and, you know, obviously they look good right now. They usually do for the party out of power. But is there anything that concerns you, pitfalls that the Republicans should be wary of that could derail the momentum that the party is enjoying right now?
Yeah, I mean, they have a ton of it right now. Actually, you know, the Quinnipiac poll today shows that Democrats are only scoring at 38% on the generic ballot. Republicans are at 46%. And if you know anything about the generic, I know you guys know this, but
If you're not familiar with the generic ballot, there's a real tilt to Democrats on the way that these polls are taken. So if it's anything, if Democrats have anything less than a 5-point lead in these things, it's usually bad news. And if they're losing by 8, you're talking about a red wave the size of a tsunami that's coming their way. The one thing that I would say that we have to be careful about is candidate selection. We had that type of momentum in 2010, and we had the Tea Party as sort of the populist impulse in the Republican Party at the time, which was great. We got a lot of good mileage out of that movement, but it did result in getting some questionable candidates up there, some bad candidates on the tickets, and that did hold back the ability to score points off of that type of a wave. And so what I'd say is that candidate recruitment, candidate selection are going to be really critical, and we need to make sure that the Republicans are putting their best foot forward in that point.
Yeah, right. We don't need anybody having TV ads saying, "I'm not a witch," for example.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly one of them. We don't need a Todd Akin, which is, I think, in 2012 or 2014, which was a similar sort of thing. That, those are the types of things that you probably want to avoid in 2022.
Yeah, makes sense. Something that's interesting, though, watching this play out, and if the trajectory holds true for the next year, something about the left, generally speaking, particularly the base of their party, which dominates, I don't think they care. When they are in power, they go for broke. They will get as much done as they can for as long as they hold it, because perhaps they know something. They know, we could lose Congress in 2022, and Republicans could gain control, but we still have the backstop of the president. And even if we lose the presidency in 2024, and the Republicans have the presidency and Congress for 2 years, you know what we'll see? We'll see them move the needle back a little bit from where we moved it, but just a little bit, and then we'll have the opportunity in the midterms in 26 to continue pushing our road to serfdom agenda that much further along. They go for broke, and Republicans are incremental. I mean, think of what beset Donald Trump in his first 2 years having to deal with Speaker Paul Ryan, for example.
I would say that that's true of the extreme wings in both parties. I think that you have that impulse. I just think that there's so many more of the progressives in the Democrat Party than there are, say, either the you could say MAGA or you could say Tea Party, in the earlier incarnation of Republican populism. I think that there is a populist impulse that says we're just going to try to ram as much through possible while we make hay while the sun shines, sort of thing. I just think it's much more of a problem for Democrats, because of the fact that progressives now make up, 80% of their seats in Congress.
Well, but the question is it a problem? Because I mean, the trend is in their direction. America is being taken down that road to serfdom. And when Republicans have had control, I mean, government hasn't shrunk. There have been some victories, temporary, fleeting, marginal. But I mean, we're continuing to walk down their path at a slower pace when we're in charge.
Right. I agree with you. When we had full control of government in Washington, the gains that we made were incremental. The tax reform thing that we passed in 2017 could have been so much better. Could have been a real reform rather than just tax cuts. And I think we were expecting that. But I think that in terms of what's going to happen this time around, I think you're right that progressives are saying, look, the writing's on the wall anyway. Let's just try to slam it as much as we can and try to make sure that Republicans can't undo it. I just don't think they're going to get the votes to do that. I don't think that there's enough of them in Congress at the moment to be able to accomplish that. I think you've got too many Democrats who are looking at the midterms and thinking they could still maybe win if they slow things down.
He is Ed Morrissey, senior editor, Hot Air, hotair.com. Ed, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Ed. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning. And you knew who you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover. What's that song, Amy?
Oh, no, can you start from the top, really?
And you knew who you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. You don't remember that?
No.
All in the Family?
Mister, we can use a man like him.
All in the Family.
Yeah. And then okay. Edith comes in.
Yeah, okay. All right. You do a great Gene Stapleton.
Thank
about
you.
As bad as my Carol
yes,
O'Connor.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
you're in the wrong key, okay?
Our friend Michael Goodwin of the New York Post thinks we've got a man named man like Herbert Hoover again. His name is Joe Biden. This week, here's how Joe Biden was selling the glorious quote-unquote infrastructure plan that he signed.
Conversations around those kitchen tables that are both profound as they are ordinary. How do I cross a bridge in a snowstorm? What happened? No, think about it. You know, you're in a situation. What happens if the bridge collapses and there's a fire on the other side? It's going to take 10 miles longer to get to the fire. People can die. I mean, this is real. This is real stuff.
Is that how he's selling the infrastructure program?
I don't know what the hell he's selling. I have no idea what he's talking
you
about.
You could fall in the water and the fire on the other side? What?
He told me to think about it. I'm trying to think about it, but nothing's coming. Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, joins us now. Michael, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's hard to top that one, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, that's
the singing or the comment?
Yeah, well, both. The eloquence of Joe Biden is commensurate to my singing, actually. Why do you think Joe Biden may be a man like Herbert Hoover again?
Well, look, I think there are a number of former presidents we can point to. My point in the comparisons was that how he's responding to inflation. We've been down this road before. We've seen other presidents fail at it. And it's for the same reason Biden is failing at it. They don't take it seriously. They fail to understand how it affects people's daily lives. I mean, they're selling big programs. They got big agendas. And meanwhile, people go to the supermarket or the gas station, and they find that, oh, it's 10 or 20 or even sometimes 30% more. I mean, you talk to anybody in any of the building trades, the price of lumber, of copper, of lead, of nails, everything is going through the roof if you can get it. And so I think Herbert Hoover comes to mind because, of course, he was considered a very wonderful man who had run relief efforts in Europe after World War One. But when he was president, he was elected president in 1928, and when the Depression began to unfold, he seemed inert. He seemed unable to grasp the severity of it. And I know there's much criticism that FDR's policy actually extended it well
and deepened it. Yeah.
But I think the Herbert Hoover reaction to the unfolding of it, the public elected FDR in 1932, giving him 42 of the 48 states. So clearly Hoover did not rise to the moment. We can talk about Gerald Ford with his silly whip inflation now. He too did not see the inflation coming. Jimmy Carter with his malaise speech, again, looked inert in the face of this rising sense of economic insecurity for the public at large.
Yeah, but the
and, of
difference...
course, George H.W. Bush, too, had the same problem, although the statistics were belatedly showed the recession had ended, but he, again, didn't show any heart or any policies that would combat the inflation that people were being swallowed up by.
Well, the difference, it seems to me, Herbert Hoover, you described as, you know, a good man. Joe Biden's a scumbag, and he always has been. I mean, he's a terrible human being. That's number one. And the similarities between all four of those presidents you just mentioned is not a single one of them understood economics, or at least they didn't convey an understanding of economics, which is why things got the why bad big government policies got the better of them electorally.
Well, that's right. I mean, their answer is always, of course, to raise taxes and to spend more government money. And so you get this, you know, depending on other economic circumstances, you get this kind of feedback loop of, you know, more and more money, either from the government or from the public, chasing after fewer and fewer goods. And so you have this inflation cycle. I mean, the labor participation matters. There are all kinds of factors that go into it. But what's happened in the last, because of the pandemic, the government has just opened the spigot and has been printing money like crazy. Now, I mean, as I read the other day, the money supply is up 40%. I mean, think of that. We all think we're getting richer, but in fact, it's all paper money that's being printed by the government, by the Federal Reserve. And so there's a great illusion out there that a lot of people are doing very well, but the inflation is undercutting the gains that workers are making. I mean, in fact, last month's report on labor showed that workers, although their wages are rising significantly, are not rising fast enough to keep up with inflation. So they're actually falling further behind each month.
So what's the way out?
Well, it seems to me the first stop is to stop the Build Back Better plan as it's construed now. Larry Summers, the former Obama economic advisor, has said that he traces it back to the March-April spending of $1.9 trillion, which was just to extend everything, to pump more money out. He thinks that was the great sin. Now, Summers thinks that as long as you raise taxes, you won't be repeating that. But we're going to find out pretty quickly with the CBO score that the taxes involved in the Democrats' Build Back Better would not cover the cost. Ergo, you are really running up the deficit and the debt and printing more money to fund these giveaways. So that is the first thing I think that has to be stopped. That would go a long way, I think, to building confidence. And then, of course, the Federal Reserve has got to play a role.
You mentioned the pandemic. So OSHA's emergency temporary standard has been sidelined by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that's not being implemented. At the same time, you have Tony Fauci now moving to the inevitable next phase of vaccine mandates, which is, you have to get the booster. The booster is part of being considered vaccinated. So now we're going to go through another iteration of this in places like New York and Illinois, Chicago, New York City, and other places beset by COVIDians, you got to show you your vax card, but it can't just be the two jabs. It's got to have the booster on it. That's coming.
Yes. Look, I think the federal government, I mean, I was reading earlier about the school board, you know, this Merrick Garland, whether he perjured himself on the FBI's hunting for domestic terrorists among parents. When the government gets desperate, it always falls back on mandates. And I'm reminded of Friedrich Hayek, the road to serfdom, that, you know, the more the government demands and mandates, it always ends up the same way, that men with guns come to your house. And that's what's happening, is that as society gets uneasy, and the federal government seems to only know one answer, which is tighten the screws, you know, put the screws on everybody. And those who don't comply, they'll become enemies of the state. And we're seeing that more and more. So if you don't comply with the vaccine, we're going to shut you down, and we're going to separate you from society in some way. Now, thankfully, the courts have blocked this, because I think it really was another step forward in this government control of everything. And if there's anything anti-American, it's this overreach of government. And this is what the left now is pushing throughout society, not just in the government, but in academia, in workplaces. They want to cancel and shut out anybody who doesn't agree. And this is a great threat to our social fabric. I mean, I fear for younger people today who are thinking this is normal.
Well, yeah, the thing that
America has always been.
The thing that it makes me, I don't know, some combination of fearful and despondent. The critical race theory and that cancel stuff, that is not popularly supported. These COVID mandates, they are popularly supported still. And you see police in Austria walking through shops, harassing customers for their vaccination card because, of course, the unvaccinated are in lockdown in Austria. And we have people like a former Chicago Public School superintendent here saying,
yep,
Austria is on the right track.
They're on to something.
Yeah, that's what's scary, is that sort of safetyist government overreach that you're talking about, but that still enjoys popular support in most of the country.
Right, and that's why it's a good sign when the courts step in and say, no, you've exceeded your authority. You know, when you hear a lot of Supreme Court arguments, one of the questions that always comes up is when the government wants to do something new and sweeping, what is the limiting principle? In other words, if you can do this, what can't you do?
Mm-hmm.
And often the losing government lawyer will argue, well, we can do whatever we want in this way and that way. And thankfully, we still have a Supreme Court that in most cases says, no, you've just tipped your hand. You don't regard any limiting principle. And limited government is the essence of the American founding. I mean, it was all about not just defeating prohibiting monarchies, but also congressional monarchies, in effect. You know, too much power in Congress, too much power in the executive, too much power in Congress. That it was about the individual liberty. And if there was an issue, the state should decide it, not the federal government. And thankfully, there are still lots of people who understand that. But as you point out, other countries don't have those safeguards, particularly in Europe. And so you get this government overreach, and Americans say, oh, why can't we be more like Europe? Well, because our Constitution knows better, and we can only hope that the Supreme Court continues to stand up for this, along with the appellate courts, stand up for the Constitution, because it is the one thing that makes us different.
Let's end on a happy note. Please tell us that handsy Andy Cuomo is going to have to pay back that $5 million he made on that ridiculous book.
Well, if that's your definition of happiness,
Schadenfreude. That's all I got.
I'm sorry to disappoint you. They may try to claw back some of it, but I think that's probably a long shot legally. He will contest it, of course, and it would, I think, perhaps trivialize the real harm that Andrew Cuomo did to New York, particularly through the sexual harassment. But the corrupting of government, the senior citizen, the nursing home policies that resulted in thousands of unnecessary deaths, the corruption of science, the fact that basically the political arm took over the Department of Health, he wouldn't even let it work with New York City's Department of Health. I mean, he was a micromanager to a great, great fault. And he corrupted a lot of things, a lot of people. There was a kind of cult around him. And I'm happy to see him go, but I don't think that trying to claw back the money will actually bring any great relief. I think the more serious investigations about the nursing home deaths, about his use of federal resources to retaliate against the whistleblowers. I think, to me, that's where the real money is.
Yeah,
not dollars, but the real important retribution for what he did.
He is Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor. Michael Goodwin, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, guys. Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.